Hey everybody, Michael Thiessen here, and you are listening to Open Mic with Michael Thiessen. And today I am joined with another Michael. We are joined with Dr. Michael Palmer, German accent to an English name. I'm so interested to hear about that story. But folks, you need to hear what Dr. Michael has to say today. He is one of the professors at the University of Waterloo who has put his career on the line to stand up against the vaccine mandates. And I'm reading a headline from the Waterloo Record that says, "The University of Waterloo fires professor over vaccine mandate. The move comes the same week the school says it's dropping its vaccine mandate. Other faculty also facing termination." So Michael, thank you for coming on. And I'm so sorry that you are caught up into the world of just utter ridiculous decisions. Thank you for being with us and sharing with us today.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here. And regarding the decision of being fired by UW, that was long expected. Indeed, I was surprised they dragged it out as long as they did. They already made noises in that direction last term, in the fall, and they backed off when I told them that, okay, they needed to find a solution for the two classes I was teaching then. But I had actually been expecting to be let go earlier this year, and now it finally happened.
And you and I were talking just before we recorded, and you had already mentioned that you had written open letter after open letter to the administration, and you only got one response. Can you share about that?
Well, I mean, I wrote the first letter to the administration, which was actually not open, but I sent it to the department chair, to the dean, to the entire chain of command, faculty association, and so on. That was a few months before they actually instituted the vaccine mandate, which came at the beginning of the fall term 2021. And in that letter, I laid out the evidence that showed that the vaccine were causing grave harm and really were not providing any benefit. And I attached an open letter, which had been endorsed by the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, a very well written letter by an MD whom I happen to know. I got no reply at all. I did not get any reply from them at all, from none of them. I even mildly insulted them just in order to provoke a response, and even that didn't work. I mean, since when can you insult a grown university professor and not get a response? You know, I knew it was right then and there that something was up. And I mean, this pattern of total silence was perpetuated also in response to later open letters, which I wrote together with a couple of colleagues, right? One of which in particular, written in August already, met with quite a bit of media attention. So the university never gave a direct reply. Yes.
You had mentioned that the only response that you had got was from a student newspaper that admonished you and the other faculty not to disseminate misinformation.
Yes. Yeah, it was not a student newspaper. It was just the, something released by the communications office of the university to the Kitchener Waterloo Record, right, which is the local newspaper here.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, look, you've got some information that you want to share with us, and yes. I really want our listeners to hear about this. And so you have some information coming out of the results of recent autopsies.
Yes.
And okay. You right. are going to share that with us now. So would you please go ahead and just right. give your presentation?
Okay, just let me bring it up here. Okay, so these are the results of a study done by a team of German pathologists, right? The lead is Professor Arne Burkhardt, a very senior pathologist who has looked at, he says, something like 40,000 autopsies during his career. That's quite a bit, right, isn't it? And so they have looked at autopsy materials from a number of persons who died within 1 week to several months after the vaccination, okay? So it's his evidence, right? I'm simply only presenting it. He lets me do it, but I wasn't directly involved in this work. Okay, so what this talk is supposed to prove is that firstly, the COVID vaccines induce very long-lasting expression of the spike protein, and not just in the injection site, but in many organs, okay? So, I mean, we were told, everybody is told more or less, you get some of the spike protein formed for a couple of days or at most a few weeks at the injection site. Not so, this is actually a much longer lasting and more widespread phenomenon. Then on top of that, the expression of the spike protein correlates with inflammation. You see lots of inflammatory cells, in particular lymphocyte. I'm going to go that into that in a minute. And we also see a correlation of this inflammation with organ damage, and sometimes obviously with deadly outcome, because otherwise obviously these people wouldn't have ended up where they did. Okay, and then on top of that, right, the damage caused by the vaccines really requires you to look closely. You actually have to do microscopic examination of the tissues in order to really spot this. If you simply use routine autopsy, which typically confines itself to macroscopic examination of the materials only, then you will likely miss it. Okay, so very briefly, right, 15 of autopsies were evaluated in detail, and 6 of these immunohistochemistry was used. I'm going to explain what that is. And also very briefly, right, the patients were mostly elderly, but a few young ones were among them, and deaths occurred between 1 week and 6 months after vaccination. Okay, so how did it come about that these investigations were carried out? Initially, these cases all had been autopsied elsewhere, and in all of these cases, the initial report was that the cause of death remained either unknown or it was a natural cause of death. And only because the bereaved families didn't settle for these vague explanations, they approached Burkhardt and asked him to take a second look. So this is what happens. Okay, and Burkhardt, after careful examination, concludes that in the majority of cases, the causation of death by the vaccine is likely or very likely. Okay, so before I go into actual data, just a brief reminder of how these COVID vaccines work. And since mostly mRNA vaccines are being used, I'm going to focus on those, right? So we start with a vaccine particle, which is a bit of mRNA encapsulated in some fat-like molecules, so-called lipids, and these lipids mediate uptake of the entire particle into a host cell, right? Then the mRNA escapes, interacts with the ribosomes, the little protein factories of the cell. This causes the spike protein to be made. The spike protein is taken to the cell surface, and it attracts the attention of the immune system, both by B cells and by T cells. And the immune system will then, on the one hand, produce antibodies against that spike protein. That's the desired outcome. But it will also attack and destroy the cell that produced this protein, right? And this is less desirable, obviously. And in fact, right, if the entire purpose is to induce an antibody response, there really is no good reason to go about that in this roundabout fashion and to sacrifice the body cells simply for the sake of making the protein, right? We can perfectly well inject the protein already and then simply confine the activity of the immune system to making those antibodies. This is what we have been doing for ages with conventional vaccines. Okay,
Michael,
so
Before you go on, I read in your bio that you've been a long-time opponent to mRNA vaccines, and is that one of the reasons why you would have been an opponent of it, just because of that very simple explanation you just give? Why would you sacrifice the host cells when you don't need to do that?
Exactly, that's a key reason, but it actually gets worse, and we will get to that at the end of this talk.
Okay.
So what kind of toxic effects do we have to expect? So I didn't really comment on part of the spike protein possibly escaping from the cell, but it's possible. We have so-called proteases on the cell surface, which can cleave off a fragment of the spike protein, which swims away and can activate blood clotting. So that is already one toxic action right there. Then obviously we have the immune response of the B and T cells against the cells expressing the spike protein. All gene-based COVID vaccines would actually cause this as well. On top of that, we also have some direct cytotoxicity of the cationic lipids, one of the lipid components of these lipid nanoparticles, which are also not so very good, but I'm not going to go into the lipid toxicity today, even though it's very interesting. Okay, so let's delve into the pathology a bit. As a preparation for that, on the left-hand side, you see a so-called lymphocyte at high magnification, right? So you can find it in the bloodstream, right? And it's essentially a blue ball. So at lower magnification, you see lymphocytes simply as dark blue round little balls, okay? And both the B cells and the T cells, which I mentioned in the slide, belong to the lymphocytes. Okay, so now on to the actual evidence. On the left-hand side, for comparison, we see a cross-section of a normal little blood vessel, and you see an intact outline. You see some red blood cells in the middle and stained blue. Here and there you see some white blood cells, right? All the colors that I'm showing here are artificial, right? So in order to better examine these tissue sections, we always stain them artificially with a mixture of dyes, and these dyes, right, bind to different structures. For example, the blue dye that we see here, or the violet dye, that purple dye that binds preferentially to nucleic acids, whereas the red dye binds preferentially to proteins. And so this way we get actually some contrast. So what you also see in this blood vessel on the left is an intact cell layer, right? You see some delicate tapestry of a single cell layer here. That's the so-called endothelium. And even so, it's a very thin and delicate cell layer. It's very important. It's in fact all that stands between you and disaster, because it is necessary to suppress blood clotting. As soon as the endothelium gets destroyed, right, the blood gets into contact with other tissues beyond the endothelium, then this will trigger blood clotting. On the right hand side, you see a destroyed blood vessel from a vaccinated person. You see that the defined outline is gone, right? So the the blood vessel outline is no longer intact. You see the endothelial cells, these spindle-shaped cells, swollen up. And what you also see is these round little balls, right? Lots of them. These are lymphocytes, and they mediate the inflammation and the destruction of this blood vessel. And the accumulation of these lymphocytes shows you that this actually happened during life. This is not just a decay process, as it might happen after death, right? Tissue decays. But the presence of the lymphocytes on the scene here, that means that this must have been already present during life. So this is an inflammation that has destroyed the blood vessels. Okay, we also see the same in larger blood vessels, now at lower power, right? Here on the right-hand side, we saw individual lymphocytes quite well. On this slide, which shows something at lower power, you see very tiny blue dots. So these are, in this case, the lymphocyte. Now, what you are looking at here is the muscular wall of the aorta, right? The aorta is the biggest artery of the body, which receives the blood ejected from the left heart, right? High volume, high pressure, so it needs to absorb a lot of mechanical load. It does that using its strong muscular layer. But what you see here in this preparation is a crack, a vertical crack right down the middle of the slide, right, which separates this wall of the aorta in two layers. And right next to this crack, you see this cloud of blue spots or blue dots, right? These are the lymphocytes. So again, this damage is apparently related to lymphocyte-mediated inflammation. Now, what we see here also is, right, this is a macroscopic look at the same thing. So this is just a slice of the aortic wall cut out, and you see particularly on the right-hand side how two layers of the wall come apart, right? So this is this crack opened wider, and in this particular patient, indeed, right, death occurred through aortic rupture, right? The wall was first split in the middle and then ruptured altogether. Now, how can we know that this was caused by the vaccine? In this particular individual case, not all required tests have been done yet, but we note that among the 15 cases that Burkhardt investigated, there were 4 cases of aortic rupture, which is a huge number, right? I mean, normally this shouldn't occur even once in 100. Now, if you have 4 such cases among 15, then obviously something is off. And you do see the lymphocytes on the scene, which are at least very suggestive. Now, how can we actually make that sure that the lymphocytes are really responding to the spike protein? And here's how. This is the method of immunohistochemistry. So that is a roundabout name. Now, what really happens here is that we detect molecules on the surface of cells. So what's done here is, let's assume a vaccine particle enters a cell, then this will induce the production of the spike protein, here shown as these blue dots on the cell surface. We can add an antibody, which we know will bind to the spike protein. We can wash off any unbound antibody. We can add a secondary antibody, which recognizes the first one, and to which we have coupled a so-called enzyme, which brings about a chemical reaction that results in the deposition of a brown pigment on the site. So, long story short, wherever we see a deposition of brown pigment, there must have been spike protein present. Okay. Now here we see a cross section through deltoid muscle, right near the injection site. The grayish polygons which you see here, these are cross sections of individual muscle fibers, and you see that several of them are fairly strongly dotted brown, right? So they have taken up the vaccine and they are now producing the spike protein. So that as it works, and this result would be expected, right? Even if these muscle cells would be attacked by the immune system and this would cause some damage, it could be lived with because the deltoid muscle is not a vitally important organ. Now, another question that arises, if we do see the expression of the spike protein, how can we be sure that this is caused by the vaccine and not because the patient in question had been infected by the virus itself? Now, here's how we can do that. The virus encodes several proteins, and the two most prominent ones are the spike and the nucleocapsid protein, right? So here in this sketch, we see both of them. Spike on the surface, nucleocapsid is the most abundant protein in the inner, in the interior of the virus particles. Now, the vaccines encode only the spike protein. So if we observe only the spike protein, the expression of only the spike protein, then this must have been due to the vaccine. On the other hand, if we see the nucleocapsid expressed, then it was most likely the virus. So the assay works as is shown here on the left-hand side. We see a low power view of an infected lung, okay? So this was a true virus, and indeed we see some brown here in this leftmost panel, which reflects that some cells here express the nucleocapsid protein. We also see the nucleocapsid protein expressed in some cells in a nasal swab, right? Just the cells from the detached from the mucous membrane of the nose. Bottom left, top right, and on the right hand side, a negative control without any brown stain. Okay, so now here we have some heart muscle tissue from an infected vaccinated patient, and we see strong brown stain when we detect the spike protein, and we see only a very feeble, nonspecific, slightly brownish background if we look for the nucleocapsid. So this was indeed due to the vaccine. So we have here, the spike protein expression in the heart tissue of a patient after vaccination. You see in the middle of the left panel, right, you see the outline of a blood vessel shown in cross-section. The spike protein is expressed right at the interior surface of the blood vessel. So these endothelial cells, they would be attacked by the immune system, and this would explain this picture of destruction which I showed you earlier on. Here we see some more blood vessels shown in cross-section, right, expressing the spike protein, and therefore it's to be expected that they would be attacked and destroyed by the immune system, by the lymphocytes. Here we see an aorta, it's actually from a different patient, but here we do see indeed that the muscle cells in the aorta also express the spike protein, and they expressed, not shown here, only the spike protein, but not the nucleocapsid. Here we
Michael,
see.
Always, yeah. Just as you're showing these slides.
Yes.
When someone would, you're explaining this in the context of the difference between, you know, observing a vaccinated patient versus someone who has just had COVID-19.
That's right.
Would you expect any of the spike protein to be in any of these different areas in the body?
That's a very good question,
if it was someone who had just, you know, had a respiratory illness?
Well, I mean, it's a very good point. I mean, in the large majority of all COVID patients, you would not expect it anywhere outside the respiratory tract. But in some cases of the natural infection, apparently this happens, can happen as well.
Okay, but what you're showing is that it is happening to a significant extent all around the body,
that is certainly
with someone who's been vaccinated.
That is true, right? The occurrence in all these interior organs makes it much more likely a priori that this is a case of vaccination as opposed to natural infection. But this test for the nucleocapsid really nails it down, right? That really shows.
Could you go back to the slide that just showed the nucleic acid?
The nucleocapsid?
How do you say that?
Nucleocapsid.
The nucleocapsid. Can you explain this slide again to me? Where is this a picture of? Is this a picture of two different samples, or is this a picture of the same sample
These are two different samples, but taken from the same organ from the same patient.
Okay.
You can only stain a given sample for one or the other. You cannot stain it for both.
Okay.
Because you use the same detection method, right?
Can you just explain to me again the difference between those two pictures? As you were explaining it,
yes.
I thought that you were saying that you would not be able to see the nucleocapsid.
Well, okay. So the, right. The staining method which we use, right, is a little bit leaky because the enzyme activity that converts the precursor, the colorless precursor molecule, to the insoluble brown pigment, such enzyme activities can also occur in human tissue itself. Right, there can be a little bit of background activity, but you could assess the extent of this background activity by omitting the first antibody, right? This little fork, which is shown here in blue, this is the first, that is the critical link that would fix, right, that would immobilize this enzyme activity to the tissues. Okay, if you omit that, then any additional brown stain that you see would be non-specific. Okay, and we have this sort of non-specific slight brown background here on the right-hand side. But we do see much stronger brown stain on the left-hand side. I guess you would agree with that?
Yes.
Right. So that, this difference indicates that there is indeed expression of the spike protein only. Now, to make that sure, I would actually have to show you, and I don't have that picture in this particular case. To make that sure, I should also show you a tissue section in which neither the spike antibody nor the nucleocapsid antibody would be present. Okay?
Okay.
I would expect this picture to turn out similar to what I'm showing here on the right-hand side, but indeed, in that regard, this slide is a little bit incomplete.
Okay.
Okay, so we see, I think I was around about here, right? So we see fairly strong expression of the spike protein in an aorta, right?
Yep.
I told you earlier that there were several cases of aortic rupture in Burkhardt's materials. And so this actually fits that observation. Here we see very strong expression of the spike protein in the spleen. We know actually from some biochemical data that originated with Pfizer and were shared with the Japanese regulators that the spleen takes up a high level of vaccine. And so that fits with the observation of strong expression. What you see here is a cross-section of an artery in the spleen, right? And you see the various muscular layers, some of which are more strongly stained than others. We saw also, we also see lots of brown stain in the vicinity of this blood vessel in the spleen tissue. And here we see conventional histopathological staining. We see a cloud of lymphocytes invading a spleen artery, right? So this structure, which is shaped like the letter C, that is actually the destroyed artery. And you see almost like the boxing glove, right? The lymphocytes punching their way into this blood vessel. So this is obviously an intense kind of destruction going on in the spleen here. Here we see heart muscle tissue on the left-hand side, healthy heart muscle fibers, right? Continuous and regularly arranged in a parallel pattern. On the right-hand side, you see disintegrating muscle fibers, right? These red little structures. And then we also again see the invasion of lymphocytes, of these blue little balls. So we actually have this lymphocytic myocarditis, yeah?
And again, this is the point that the vaccine initiates not just the production of the antibodies to destroy the virus, but the antibodies actually destroy the cells.
Absolutely. Both the antibodies and the T lymphocytes, they conspire in destroying the cells that produce the spike protein. You're absolutely right. And another interesting point about this is that the age of this patient, he was in his 50s, right? You hear that myocarditis is only ever mentioned in connection with young people. Now, here we see a case, and there were actually several cases in Burkhardt's materials of myocarditis also in middle-aged and elderly patients. Now, in those patients, right, clinically you would often jump to the conclusion if there is some acute heart event, you would simply assume it to be a heart attack. Right, so I think that at least some of the heart attacks diagnosed in middle-aged and elderly people might indeed be myocarditis. Even so, it is clear that real heart attacks due to blood clotting also are triggered by the vaccine. Okay, lung tissue. On the left-hand side, healthy lung tissue, you see lots of white. These are the air-filled spaces, and the air-filled spaces are separated by thin, delicate tissue layers, and within those you see red. These are the blood-filled capillaries. Okay, on the right-hand side you see the lung tissue of a vaccinated person, and you see again a big, huge blob of lymphocytes, which really doesn't belong into the lung, right? And here, a more advanced stage. This is also lung, even if it doesn't look like it, because most of the air is gone. The air-filled spaces are being filled up with connective tissue or scar tissue, if you will. And you also see, again, lots of these blue balls, the lymphocytes, so again, lymphocytic infiltration. Okay, so I could go on through a bunch more organs, but I won't. I will just simply summarize what we have seen here. Burkhardt calls it lymphocyte amok, right? The lymphocytes are attacking all organ systems, right? In particularly also some of the vital organs. We do see blood vessel destruction, which promotes blood clotting, and right, that agrees with the observation of deep vein thrombosis, lung embolisms, sinus vein thrombosis in the brain, stroke, heart attack, and so on. And we see, right, the attack is most likely triggered by spike protein expression in the vessels, but also elsewhere. Okay, and then on top of that, we also seem to see immunosuppression, and the only way I can understand it, I'm not an immunologist, so I'm trying to get some insights from actual immunologists on this question, how these things fit together. But it seems to me that the lymphocytes are kept so busy with attacking self that there is no attention left in the immune system for defending against actual pathogens. Okay. Now, very lately we have learned, this is no longer from Burkhardt, right? This is from a Swedish study, that the mRNA vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, gets copied into DNA and inserts into the cellular genome. Why is this interesting in this regard? First off, the evidence of this insertion is this band of, right, in the middle of the of each of these gray pictures, right? You see this series of little stripes, dark stripes. These are DNA fragments which have been characterized for their size, right? And they show the expected size which should result from the PCR experiment. And the control samples, which I won't go into, show that this indeed, right, this DNA is indeed now in the cellular DNA and not in the RNA or anywhere else. So why is this interesting in this context? Because we do see this expression of the spike protein even after several months, right? Now, the injected mRNA shouldn't really last that long. The question then is, how is the production of spike protein sustained for such a long period of time? Insertion of the gene into the DNA is one possibility, right? So it could be that the spike protein is actually, after some time, supplied by the genes which have been inserted into the DNA of the cells of the body. And that would obviously be a pretty bad scenario. Okay, so you mentioned earlier on, right, the question as to why I'm opposed to mRNA vaccines, and here is why. Very briefly, how does the immune system deal with a regular virus to which it has no immunity yet, right? So in the primary infection, the first time we encounter a virus, there's nothing to stop it from entering our body cells and then causing the body cells to produce the viral proteins. This will then wake up the immune system, which will proceed to attack those cells, and there will be some cell death, and this is what makes you sick. Now, after the first infection, you have immunity, including antibodies, and if the virus should visit again, then the antibodies will bind to the virus particles, it will prevent them from entering cells, and will instead arrange for the destruction of those particles. Now, what happens with mRNA vaccines? The first injection, right, it looks sort of similar, right? We have a larger number of invading particles, so we can expect more intense symptoms and more intense damage, but in principle, we have expression of the spike protein in this case in those cells, attacked by the immune system, and then destruction of the cell. Now, what happens with the booster injection? We may have antibodies, but these antibodies have nothing to grab onto on these vaccine particles because there simply is no copy of the protein present, okay? There is only the blueprint, there's only the RNA, but there's no protein copy, so the antibodies won't recognize it, which means that nothing will be able to stop these particles to enter the body cells and to initiate another round of damage. But because the immune system is already riled up at this point, it will spring into action immediately, right, when the expression levels are likely highest for the spike protein, and therefore the damage will be even more intense after this than after the first time.
And this can I ask a question about that, Michael?
Just a sec. This will repeat after each booster injection, right? Yeah. Nothing will ever stop this process. Okay, what's the question?
So my question is this how you would see after the booster such a traveling in the body? Because if this, if the injection contains simply the mRNA with no protein, and it moves around until it connects with a cell, it would seem that it would just move farther in the body each time that the booster would happen.
Well, whether it's getting farther the second time after the first, that is a possibility has been suggested. I have not seen any data that this is indeed the case.
Okay.
But there's indeed nothing to stop it, right? So we see already after the first injection that it can travel all over the place. We have also fairly strong accumulation. I mentioned strong accumulation in the liver and in the spleen, but we also have it, for example, in the adrenal glands and in the ovaries. And from that, we must expect it will also accumulate in the breast glands of breastfeeding moms. And indeed, there are some cases in the VAERS and the Eudravigilance databases, adverse events databases, of breastfed children who fell severely ill or even died shortly after their breastfeeding mothers had been vaccinated. All of this stuff could have been predicted from preclinical data. None of these things, none of these problems that were predictable were actually investigated in any of the clinical or preclinical trials. You know, it is just gross systematic negligence, right? It is not just incompetence, because not all people working for the FDA or for the European Medicines Agency, they are not all stupid. I don't even believe that they are all bribed. I think it's worse. I think they are actually threatened. I don't think that you could get all of these people to sell their souls for 30 silver coins. I don't believe that. So this is really, this is just gross, systematic malpractice and endangerment. It is conscious, intentional endangerment of the public. That's the only way I can look at it. I cannot believe that so much harm could have been done simply due to incompetence. I just don't believe that. Okay.
It's interesting. You use a word there, predictability.
Yes.
And even as someone who, I'm not a strong chemist in any way. In fact, I remembered being overwhelmed. I enjoyed grade 11 chemistry, but then when we got into grade 12 chemistry, I remember just getting lost.
Okay.
But as you are just showing some of those simple slides, the word predictability does seem to be very relevant, because someone of your ability and someone who is looking for these things, the logic of the slides seems very sound. If the vaccine is delivering an mRNA that does not have a protein to be attacked by, you know, after, you know, the second booster, that the antibodies, yes, will leave it alone and it will infect more cells. That yes, doesn't sound to me to be any type of contentious, like it would seem ridiculous for someone to say, no, that's not a possibility. We should not explore that scientifically.
Well, it's actually unavoidable, right? As you say, it's predictable. I mean, I started looking into this mRNA vaccine. I mean, the first time I ever heard about nucleic acid vaccines was in the 1990s, and I immediately thought, what a stupid idea, because it was obvious already, right, that you would sacrifice cells simply for the sake of making protein. Why would you do that? If indeed the purpose is to make antibodies, or if that is deemed sufficient to make antibodies, why would you do it? You wouldn't. There's no need for it. And now, when I started looking into these mRNA vaccines, I realized this problem with the inability of antibodies to stop entry of the vaccine particles into the cells. It took me all of 30 minutes. And I wrote about this and I talked about it even before the first injections were given, that this would be a problem. And I must also say that anybody who works in the area must be aware of it. I mean, if I, as a total outsider, need 30 minutes in order to understand this problem, I think somebody who works in the area should really be aware of it. I mean, this is just not possible for people to work in this area and not realize it.
Now, Michael, I interrupted you with a question. Did you have further slides that you wanted to share, or?
No, I was done. I had one summary slide, and that was simply pretty much the information I had already talked about, so I don't think I need to bring it up again. So
as an academic, as somebody, you know, I assume a tenure professor at the University of Waterloo, which again, tenure is that you can't get fired for virtually anything. What are you going through when in an area of your expertise in chemistry, where you are interacting with physicians who are doing autopsies, utilizing unique chemical reactions, you know, to observe these things, well, being ignored by your administration and then being scolded about misinformation. How are you dealing with that?
Well, I mean, I've read the book 1984 and several other books along these lines, and I mean, this is where we are right now. I mean, this is no longer about science. But I mean, you have to actually be inside the academic environment for a while right now in order to realize just how much it has changed the last couple of years. Okay, there is no actual discussion. It is all a one-way street. We have, right, we used to joke in our little circle of refuseniks at Waterloo. We call the administration the Kremlin, right, because this is how it works. I mean, you have a total one-way street of propaganda. There is nobody to engage with you. There is no rational discussion of any sort. Right? And I mean, too many people have bought into this. I mean, on my own background, I'm actually trained as a medical doctor, but I'm only by accident in the chemistry department. I was a bit surprised they hired me here, but as a biochemist, I guess I got along. So I'm a medical doctor by training, and I worked with Dr. Sucharit Bhakti for 10 years between 1990 and 2000. And I got my board certification in Germany in medical microbiology. So that's this lab diagnostic of pathogenic microbes. Okay, so it's actually, this kind of stuff is actually right up my street. And since UW doesn't have a medical school, I'm probably the only MD with a specialization in the area of microbes on entire campus. They were not interested in my opinion ever. There was nobody listening, nobody actually discussing with me. There's nothing doing. On the other hand, funny part, you know, in 2020, when they had started up with all their fake emergency measures and canceled all the labs, right? There were some grad students and fourth year students groping about for credits to graduate. So then I consented to teach a course in computer programming. I have no credentials in computer programming, but I have never proven to anybody that I can write a line of code. I'm just a hobby programmer. That I was allowed to do, okay? That as a medical doctor, I could teach grad students and undergrad students in computer programming without anybody actually checking up on me what I was doing. That was fine. They trusted me with that. But if I try to get a point across that falls squarely into my actual expertise, that is not relevant simply because it does not fit the narrative.
I kind of want you to retell that, or I'm going to retell it. So if I heard you correctly, yes. In the area of expertise, you were fired. Well, we're going to walk backwards. Micromanaged, ignored, called, sharing misinformation, and then ultimately terminated.
Oh, you're freezing up for me right now.
In an area where you're a hobbyist, which I do want, I want to make a point of that, yes, for a moment. In an area where you're a hobbyist,
yes,
you had no observation, no oversight, and no penalty while you were teaching.
Yes,
Michael, I want to bring up the point for our listeners that's really important, and it comes up to this word hobbyist that you use. We've recently seen in the United States the accepting of a judge to the Supreme Court who would refuse to define a male or a female because she wasn't a biologist. And everybody just needs to hear, quite honestly, what you're saying here, Michael, about being a hobbyist. I'm listening to your presentation as a non-chemist. I fully admit, as you've been talking, I've been going, this is why I got confused during grade 12 chemistry, because it's really technical language, it's technical verbiage.
Yeah.
But right. You know, if you and I were to sit down with that slide three or four times, that presentation, and I were to ask you every dumb question that I had, and when I say dumb question, I mean every question that I had, okay, please explain that word. Repronounce that one. Just doesn't take that much to understand some of the things that you're sharing.
Your questions were very much on point. You had very good questions, I must say.
Well, thank you. I pride myself in, when I have no idea what someone's talking about, to be able to ask them a question to follow up with. No, but you understand what I'm trying to say? Like, so you would never say to your students, don't learn because you're not already an expert. You would say, listen, hey, if I've got to re-explain that slide. So from day one throughout this entire journey, I've had the privilege to talk to experts like yourself who are saying to the other experts, what are you doing? But you don't hear any of these types of in-depth explanations as to how the vaccines work from the other side. You hear more of what you were talking about there, just people with their heads down, no response. Don't get centered out and keep going. So I'm just encouraging all of the listeners, listen to some of the technical stuff and learn, and you'll join the dialogue and do just fine. And Michael, I thank you for explaining those slides and particularly about this autopsy evidence. Do you think these studies will grow? Do you think that the gentleman you're interacting with in Germany, that they're going to have more access to these situations?
I mean, he is actually swamped with inquiries from the public, and I don't think he has a shortage of cases to look after. I think what he has is a shortage of time and manpower. So that's the problem right now. But there are some participating pathologists in the background. And so I hope they will keep going, because I think this is some of the strongest evidence so far. As a medical person, if you are presented this evidence and you don't shut your mind from the very beginning, I think this must be very deeply troubling to you, because it is so clear. I mean, the connection is so clear, right? You have the specific evidence of the spike protein, you have the exclusion of the expression of the nuclear capsid, which indicates it's indeed vaccine-related. You see this expression even after months. You see it in places where it really shouldn't occur, okay? And you see the correlation with the inflammation. You see all the strange adverse events which are being recorded by bears and ultravigilance, which now really find the explanation in this pathology. It is not as if there is no clinical, there are no clinical observations to correspond to this. There are plenty of them. I mean, ultravigilance, which collects the adverse events reports from the entire European Union, they now stand at 42,507 casualties. And I heard recently that there was actually from this very gentleman, Arne Burkhardt, he wrote to me that the University of Marburg in Germany, they set up an ambulance for a clinic, right, walk-in clinic for people with presumed vaccine adverse events. They are getting 200 to 400 visits every day. And this is not Berlin, this is not Hamburg, this is a small town. I guess that some people travel considerable distance over land in order to even have somebody listen to them. But this is not, it's not a convenient location for a very large population. This is a city of, I don't even know, 60,000 people or something.
You know, Dr. Palmer, I did an interview a number of months ago with a gentleman named Dr. Stephen Pellick.
Yes.
And we talked about some of the same things, and we just didn't have the slides that you were just showing. Yes. But he also really explained to everybody how the major differences were the three, the spread, the elongated exposure to, or the elongated presence of the spikes protein, and the body attacking these very cells. And so that was a very helpful presentation. And then now you're coming along saying, look, we've looked at the bodies, we've done the autopsies.
Steve Pellick is a very good immunologist. Yes, he knows what he's talking about. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so I have a few follow-up questions for you then, and you may be able to answer them, you may not. These are the questions that I'm coming across. So you talked about the difference between the first shot and the second shot. Now we have individuals taking the third booster. Yeah. So I have individuals who just contracted COVID-19, and it was after they have had their third booster. And I would put up my hand in the room and say, if you've been in a lake and you've been swimming and you found yourself at the bottom of the lake after you've put on three life jackets, number one, the first life jacket didn't work. Number two, the second life jacket didn't work. The third life jacket certainly didn't work. You're at the bottom of the lake. Maybe you should admit that you bought faulty life jackets. Now, these people, without a breadth of a moment of thought, will respond and say, no, I had a much more more minor reaction to the virus because I've had the vaccine. Can you comment on that? Of course, there's an element of law, you know, there's the desire to believe the narrative. So they're just saying, hey, the vaccines work, and they're repeating that. But from the observations that you've been making, Is there any truth to the statement, well, I would have a more minor reaction to the actual virus than if I hadn't been vaccinated?
Well, I mean, the evidence as to whether the vaccinations reduce rates of infection or reduce disease severity is really all over the place. Whatever you can only pick and choose. You can find papers that say there's no efficacy at all. You can find other papers that say the efficacy is very high. With Omicron specifically, there seems to be an acknowledgement, a realization that the vaccines really don't work anymore. I mean, Omicron is so highly mutated relative to the original strains against which these vaccines were developed, that there really isn't any advantage to speak of anymore. There are even several studies that find out a negative efficacy. So it's officially documented in a number of papers that people who got vaccinated are more likely to contract the infection than unvaccinated ones. Okay. Omicron itself is said to be very infectious, but on the other hand, clinically milder than preceding strains of SARS-CoV-2. And on top of that, I mean, even with the early strains of SARS-CoV-2, it was clear from the beginning that the most severe outcomes, deaths, were really practically limited entirely to people with comorbidities. People who are knocking on death's door anyway, these were the ones who would succumb to COVID also. And in this regard, it's really not much different from any other old respiratory pathogen, right?
So that leads me to my second question.
Yeah.
So you brought up the very different variants.
Yeah.
We've been watching the flu vaccines for years, and it's always been my understanding that you would have to go out and get another inoculation for a different strain.
Yeah.
So am I right in assuming, you know, what you just said makes perfect sense to me? We're going to have this COVID-19 in the coronavirus around. It's going to be multiple strains. How could it be that these vaccines are still even appropriately targeted or marketed to be effective when it breaks all protocol of, hey, we've got a new strain, we need a new vaccine?
I think they are going to keep going with these vaccines as long as some people will still take them. This is just simply the maximized return on investment. They have already stockpiled all these millions of doses, so they are bloody well going to distribute them. It's nothing to do with medical benefits or anybody. This is just solely for getting their bucks worth. That's
it. Because with the flu shot, you would be taking a flu shot every year that was developed for a certain strain, but there would be multiple strains out in the public anyways. So you would, I think it was like a 33% chance that you would even, that what you took would even be applicable for what you might come across. Go ahead, Michael. I just didn't hear that last part.
I would not bother with flu shots. It's not worthwhile. It's not worth it. It's, as you say, the likelihood of success is very feeble. There's really no good evidence that they do any good at all. So I would recommend you just simply take vitamin C and D and you forget about all these flu shots.
Yeah, and particularly when it comes down to mandating people and firing people over something that is as experimental, more experimental than your annual flu shot, the world's lost its mind.
A while ago, my wife started mandating vitamin C and D on me, and I must admit, she actually was successful. So since I comply with her mandate, I actually haven't had a flu in a long time.
That's a different type of mandate. I think you're still allowed to be a free man, but happily married is a good idea as well. Okay, so as we bring our draw time to close, I want to talk about your last name and then your accent, because you mentioned that just before we got on and we started recording, and I'm glad you mentioned it, because Michael Palmer, I was expecting, maybe someone with just a Canadian accent or somebody with an English accent. How is it that you have such a strong English name with a German accent going with it?
The German accent is easily explained. I was born in Germany and spent the first 40 years of my life there, so I think that accounts for that. In Germany, the name is actually unusual, so I always had to give my last name twice because it's unusual, and in North America I find I have to give it twice because of my accent.
Yes, no, that'll be it. Yes. Yeah, everybody would be like, "No, I'm sorry. Was that Von Palmer?" Or what? They'd stumble along that because of your accent. That's totally true.
But in Germany, apparently, the name came about as a shortened form of a Belgian name, De Palmener. So apparently, some ancestor just a couple of centuries ago migrated from Belgium to some place in Germany, and then over time, the last name got simplified from De Palmener to Palmer, and this is the way it stayed.
Okay.
So there's no English or Canadian heritage of any kind.
Okay. My listeners are good listeners. They knew that we mentioned that at the beginning, and they wanted that resolved. I could tell. So. Well, look, I just want to thank you for coming on. It breaks my heart to read articles like that Waterloo Record article. It really saddens me as a man who we all struggle with sin, but as a man who tries to uphold morality and virtue and see virtue, Michael, it is always so hurtful to me to watch individuals like yourself who are trying to be diligent with your work and honest with your appraisal of the situation. And you know better than I, within the medical world, we've talked about this time and time again. This is what informed consent is all about. This is what second opinions are all about. This is why we would not move forward with procedures hastily. This is why study must happen. And I just saddens me that you're going through it, but I'm thankful, Michael, for your strong stance and for you taking standing up for your students and for other Canadians.
Okay, thank you. But if I could comment on this briefly, I mean, as the saying goes, right, each time a door closes, another one opens. So, I mean, because of taking this stand, I have met so many great people over the last 1 or 2 years. I'm working with an amazing group of people called the Doctors for COVID Ethics.
Excellent. That's great.
Excellent physicians, excellent scientists, really, really deep conversations. It's a great group. That's just an example. Also outside this group, I have met others. So it was the right way the right path for me to take, and I'm happy I took it.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, thank you for coming on and discussing with me. And everybody, just remember, you can do your investigation. And now we're now seeing further evidence of these vaccine harms, and we're going to continue to see them because of the way that these vaccines do not work and the way that they do function. And so we're very concerned that individuals would be rushing out to do this. Of course, so concerned by the governmental pressure in order to do these things. And keep listening, keep reading, and don't just get lots of second opinions as you navigate this new world of individuals who, it's just a mob out there just saying, do what you're told. You know, if you want to protect your family and yourself, you've got to get out there and you've got to be careful. So thank you, Dr. Michael Palmer, for being with us today. And it's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Thank you.
Okay. Godspeed, everyone.